I'm Christopher Light, and this is The Connection. Cooking is as much a science as it is an art, and don't let a French chef who insists on whipping egg whites in a copper bowl tell you otherwise. It's really the chemistry that makes the mayonnaise. Chemists in the kitchen know the universal truth is that if you want to make flavorful, moist, eye-appealing meals and sweets, you've got to be able to do more than follow recipes. It's science that makes food taste good. It's a scientist who understands the alchemy of ingredients combined with the effects of heat, cast iron, aluminum, or stainless steel. We're talking this hour about the science of cooking. Connection listeners, do you know why your cake fell, or why your chicken is rubbery, or why your asparagus spears turn brown? If you're the kind who's happy to find a science experiment in your refrigerator, make the mad scientist in the kitchen connection at 1-800-423-8255 or 1-800-423-TALK. Our guest in the studio is Christopher Kimball, publisher and editor of Cook's Illustrated Magazine. Also, food scientist Harold McGee joins us by phone from Palo Alto. He's the author of The Curious Cook and The Philosophical Inquiry on Food and Cooking. The New York Times described him once as part poet, part mad scientist, part dad who cooks. Also joining us is Craig Shelton, who studied molecular physics and biochemistry at Yale. He's now the chef at the Ryland Inn in White House, New Jersey. Christopher Kimball entered the studio like a sort of Mr. Wizard of the kitchen with all sorts of pots and pans and ingredients. What are you going to tell us about the chemistry of food, Christopher Kimball?
I'm going to tell you that the chemistry of food matters. That, you know, it's sort of like a 15-year-old who thinks they can listen to rock and roll when they play air guitar, everything's going to be fine. Most people go into the kitchen and think they can reproduce that terrific dinner they had last night at that 4-star eatery by simply improvising. And my philosophy is totally different, which is that cooking is identical to playing music. You can't sit down at the piano without knowing music theory and practice. You can't go into the kitchen with 10 minutes of experience and turn out great food. So chemistry matters. So it's like eat your vegetables. It. Yeah, it's not easy.
I expect the ingredients to save me. So what are the pots and pans here, Prue?
Okay, we have a quick experiment. I have some baking soda, which is the key leavener for most people, a chemical leavener at home. And I have some water, and I'm going to put a tablespoon of baking soda in water, and nothing happens. And now I'm going to put a tablespoon of baking soda into vinegar and acid, and let's see if we can hear that. It's like Alka-Seltzer.
I can see it, yeah.
Hopefully it doesn't bubble over into the studio here. So the basic notion is that for cakes and cookies and muffins and biscuits, it's all about a balance of baking soda and an acid, and you have to get that balance right. For example, in a chocolate chip cookie, if you have too much baking soda, too much leavener, the cookie will turn out flatter than if you have less. What happens is carbon dioxide bubbles are created and they rise, and if there are too many of them, there's too much leavener, too much carbon dioxide, the cookie will be like a balloon. It will inflate essentially and explode and collapse on itself. So balance in a chemical reaction in baking is very important.
So what makes the properly gooey, sticky, vaguely molten chocolate chip cookie as opposed to that sort of stiff, stuck, shortbready, crumbly cookie?
You've just asked the $64,000 question. The cookies are the most difficult thing in the world. I'd rather come up with a souffle. The problem with cookies is little things matter. So I could answer by saying the amount of sugar has a lot to do with moistness. It depends on how you bake it. If you have a big piece of dough for a big cookie, it can be chewy and moist inside, and the outside can be crispy. Smaller cookies tend to be a little harder because they're thinner. It also has to do with other things in the batter, whether you use brown sugar or not. So there's a lot of things that go on in that. There's probably 10 things that affect how chewy a cookie is, how much you bake it. You know, most folks at home overbake their cookies. They wait till they're set up, till they come out of the oven. A cookie, if you want it chewy, should look half-baked. You take it out and it continues baking. So probably the easiest answer is the amount of sugar and underbaking will give you the nice chewy texture.
Harold McGee, in Palo Alto, how much chemistry can we absorb this hour? And where would you begin with the non-scientist in the kitchen?
Well, that's a good question. I would just like to point out that you know, cooks were doing wonderful, amazing, delicious cooking long before scientists got into the act of explaining things. And that it seems to me that the reason that the science of cooking is so useful these days is that many cooks don't have the decades and decades of experience that they used to get back in the old days when you started out as an apprentice at the age of six and worked your way up the ranks in the kitchen. I think a lot of cooks have a lot of knowledge in their fingertips, but for those of us who don't have the experience of cooking 18 or 20 hours a day, and in fact are grateful for that, a knowledge of the principles can come in very handy.
Give us some principles to start with.
Okay. Well, you mentioned the issue of water and tea. Water seems as though it might be, you know, the simplest of ingredients. It comes out of the tap. It looks the same everywhere. But in fact, water is very different in different places and can influence your food in very different ways in different places. And it has to do with the balance of acid and base in the water, and the balance of acid and base can influence as simple a thing as a cup of tea, because the ingredients in a cup of tea will behave very differently depending on that chemical balance. And it turns out that you can change that chemical balance simply by putting a pot of water on to boil and then having the phone ring, and you let it boil a minute or two longer than you would otherwise, carbon dioxide that's dissolved in the water will dissipate. The pH will change, the acidity will change, and your cup of tea will end up very flat.
How do you want to instruct us on our chocolate chip cookies or our chicken soup, for that matter?
How do you mean instruct you?
Well, give us the benefit of chemical science here.
Okay. Well, in the case of something like a chicken soup, that's, again, a matter of extraction, just the same way that making a cup of tea or a cup of coffee is. And so it becomes important how long you leave the ingredients in the soup, what temperature you let the soup come to, how long it's at that temperature. Paying attention, as Chris said, to the details will help you get a result that you know, comes close to matching your expectation and what you desire. It's true that you can't simply look at something, at chicken soup, for example, and say that it's simply the sum of its ingredients. It's the sum of its ingredients plus what they've all been through.
I want to introduce Craig Shelton from the Ryland Inn in New Jersey. I didn't mention the numbers. How many stars in your New York Times rating, Craig?
We're a four-star New York Times restaurant.
Big time.
Yeah, it's a very special place out in the country, in the horse country, on a beautiful property. And I'm so excited to be able to join this panel, because in 1984, when Mr. McGee published On Food and Cooking, I think I was one of the first people to read it cover to cover. And since that time, I think I've read the book at least a dozen times through, and it's been part of the training curriculum of all of my students and cooks over the years.
Craig Shelton, how does science inform your cooking?
Well, I could put it at two levels. How it informs me personally is also different than how I use it to help young people to become very strong cooks much more rapidly. Fortunately, with my background, I can read Harold's book and comprehend what's going on probably more easily than someone without a strong science background. So my role as a teacher in the practical sphere touches upon what Harold said earlier. Very, very few cooks today have the benefit of 10 or 20 or 30 years of experience and learning how to judge empirically what happens in the pan. I sort of act as an interpreter of the science community. I create five or six scientific metaphors which explain to people in an easy, comprehensible way groups, how different groups of foods basically act. Mm. We break it down into protein theory. We talk about green vegetables. We talk about starchy vegetables. We talk about emulsions. And I won't go through, you know, descriptions of actual chemical processes going on, but I will describe it in something of a heuristic fashion so that they can understand what they're looking for, what reactions to expect that could happen. And they and what can happen is we find that with this framework, young people here can learn how to cook well in half the time.
But as Harold McGee says, we're all, you know, the whole mission in a way is to recover in complete in knowledge what peasant cooks spent thousands and thousands of years doping out. What does all that tell you about a great meal? Or how do you get to a great meal balancing or contrasting starchy vegetables or protein theories?
Certainly science alone won't do it. I think like a great writer has to be a great reader first. A great cook has to be a great eater first. I would advise anyone who wants to become a more successful cook or chef to eat well, to dine at the best restaurants around the world, to read everything you can. So many of the decisions are aesthetic, of course, not just chemical. But can you learn how to control what's going on in the pan? Can you learn how to get the result you're looking for with a general or basic scientific overview? Absolutely.
Chris Kimball, you've got 10 ovens in your test kitchen. I mean, how do you refine these goals?
Well, we take a different approach, which is show me, which is we like the science, but we say, hey, let's roast 40 chickens and let's do low heat and high heat and low heat then high heat and let's try covering it and let's try injecting some salt solution into it and brining it, et cetera, et cetera. Let's try air drying it in the refrigerator overnight, and then we just see what works. So we sort of work backwards. We test everything. We try what Hal McGee says in his book. We'll try what Julia says in her book. We'll try something from the New York Times. We'll try 20 recipes or 30 recipes, and then at the end of the day, whatever works is what we come out with. Then I get on the phone with someone like Hal or another scientist to find out why it worked. That's how we do it.
Well, for example, and you brought stainless steel bowls with you. How do you judge the effect on the chemistry, but the effect on the palate of, say, a cast iron pan or an aluminum pan, or even, say, between broiling the meat and cooking it on the top of a stove on a frying pan?
Well, let's take the example you started with, which was the copper bowl for souffle. I tested that endlessly and found that if you just whip up the whites in the copper bowl, you won't find much difference between a stainless steel bowl and a copper bowl. When you go bake the souffle, I found that the copper bowl turned out egg whites that had a souffle that had a very fine texture, and the top was crisp and brown. It was very different.
Really?
And for years I've been decrying French chefs with a silly notion of buying a $200 bowl. It turned out actually the souffle was better, which is kind of useless information because no one's going to do it in a copper bowl these days. But that's how I found out. So the cast iron, let's take that as an example. People say cast iron imparts a flavor if there's an acid. That's true up to a point, but if you season the pan properly, there's a barrier between the iron and the food. And I found that unless it's extremely acidic, you don't get too much flavor. So, you know, the problem with science is there's always more than one thing going on. A caller might ask, you know, why did my cake fall? Well, there's probably 15 things I'd have to ask her or him before I could get the answer because there's so many possibilities. So the science is useful, but it can also be very confusing if you don't have all the information.
You know, that copper bowl story is a wonderful example of the fact that something that you might dismiss as an old cook's tale, something that just sounds completely loony, turns out to be way ahead of even the chemistry of our day, because I first read that that idea that whipping egg whites in a copper bowl gave you a better foam in Julia Child back when I was writing on food and cooking, and I thought it just didn't make any chemical sense. So I pretty much ignored it until I saw that, in fact, the French cooks were doing this back in the 18th century. And I thought, well, if it's been around for a couple hundred years, maybe it's worth taking a look at. And I went into the chemical literature, didn't find anything at all about it. But when I did some experiments, I found that, in fact, copper is absorbed from the surface of the bowl, and it does make a difference to the behavior of the proteins. And so we ended up publishing a scientific paper on it, you know, based on a 200-year-old French tradition.
Harold McGee, what about the science of cast iron pots?
Well, Chris is absolutely right. Cast iron is a very reactive surface, especially to acidic foods. And in fact, in the old days, this was probably nutritionally very useful because you would end up with more iron in your stew than you would have had you cooked in some other kind of pot. Mm. But you don't necessarily want these days to have that kind of metallic overtone to your stew. But if a pot has been properly seasoned and seasoned enough, then that's not an issue. Now, if you've only just seasoned it, it doesn't take that much acid to break through a new layer of seasoning. If it's been seasoned and well seasoned for several years, then it's not a problem.
Connectionistas, we're talking about chemistry and science in the kitchen. The phone's 1-800-423-8255 or 1-800-423-TALK. Michael is calling from Everett, Massachusetts.
Hi, how you doing?
Good, Michael. What's for lunch?
Well, I'm a baker, actually.
Okay.
And I'm at my shop, and I make scones, and I do them all by hand, and I use baking powder as a leavening agent. And what I'm finding is that in order to get a couple of days off, because I'm just a one-man operation, I freeze them raw and then bake them from frozen. And what I'm finding is about 4 days after they've been frozen, they don't rise as well. And I'm wondering if there's anything I can use or something to preserve the baking powder or use something different to increase the amount of time I can keep them in the freezer.
Harold McGee.
The problem is that baking powder is reacting even in the freezer. If it gets wet, then it's slowly losing its power.
Right.
So there are baking powders that really aren't available to the home baker, but are available to professionals that actually are much slower acting, and in fact act only when the temperature of the scone gets above a certain point. So
oh, really?
in the refrigerator, it won't react. So I'd suggest you check with your supplier for those other alternative baking powders.
Okay, great. And using a baking soda, would baking soda react the same way once it's wet? It starts to react?
Yeah, it's gone. If it gets wet, it starts to bubble, yeah.
Michael, glad you raised the question. Glad you got an answer. 1-800-423-8255. The science of cooking connection. Chris is on the line.
Hi.
Hello, Chris.
Hello there. I own and have read Mr. McGee's book. It's super, and I subscribe to Mr. Kimball's magazine, which is...
You're qualified.
Half science and half cooking, my two favorite subjects. I am a home cook, and I do cooking for my family as well as for small groups, and I have found that even with all my reading, my own personal mistakes have been my best teachers, and I love to read the results of their test kitchens and listen to other people talk. But I've had to make my own mistakes along the way to really teach myself. And when people say, oh, I could never make this dish or that dish, I have to tell them, well, there was a point where I couldn't either. And I want to ask your guests their opinion on people who are first starting out with a little bit more intricate cooking. How important is it that they make their own mistakes to learn hands-on?
Christopher Kimball.
Well, that's all I do for a living is make mistakes and then tell people about what the stupid things I did. So very important. I think it's important, though, a lot of mistakes have been made already, and there are a lot of things that are already decided. You know, we can talk about what happens at meat at different temperatures or what kind of pan to use for sautéing. So I think anyone learns from their own mistakes, but it is awful.
Be particular. What's your most useful mistake, Christopher Kimball?
My most useful mistake, what happens when I roasted meat at different temperatures. I found I was roasting, let's say, a chuck roast, 3-pound chuck roast at 400 or 450 degrees, and it was always dry and leathery. And then I discovered that at lower temperatures, because I roasted five roasts at different temperatures, because that's the kind of guy I am and nothing else to do one Sunday, I found out that lower temperatures, the meat came out perfectly cooked. And that was all because of a simple scientific principle. It was conduction, which means at high temperatures, the outside of the meat got very overcooked by the time the inside cooked. At lower temperatures, like a prime rib I do at 250, the inside has time to absorb the heat from the outside, so it's much more even cooking. So a simple thing like conduction changed how I cook a roast now.
You know, Chris, that's probably one of the single most important things that I feel could be communicated to the home cook, probably to a lot of chefs in this country. Most protein is being cooked at a far too high a temperature for far too long. And I think that's the one single thing that could make everyone eat a lot better.
It's too high a temperature and too long?
Yes.
You cook it slower and cooler.
I think it all started,
faster.
People have taken Escoffier's book as the Bible for so many years, and he came up with this theory that searing the meat locks in the juices. And if you take that extension and start saying, well, if a little sear does a good thing, a lot of sear must do a better thing. And it was applied to the roasting in the ovens as well. And it's really just about the worst thing we can do in the whole kitchen is to roast things at a very high temperature or saute things at a very high temperature for prolonged periods of time. And we just want to get a beautiful surface and then change our heat to a more moderate approach, and the results will be superior every time.
And in fact, not a cook to blame for the searing theory, but actually a chemist. So that shows that chemistry can occasionally lead you down the wrong path as well. That was a German chemist by the name of Liebig who came up with the idea that searing a piece of meat would seal in the juices and prevent it from going dry.
He sold the idea to Escoffier?
Yep, he did.
We're at it, can I just ask you my own little riddle? What do cooks mean nowadays when they talk about letting meat rest in the middle of the process?
That's very important. Actually, we have a recipe for a pork roast where we take the pork out halfway through cooking for half an hour, go get a beer, come back, throw it back in the oven, and that way it comes up to an even temperature. But to let it rest after it is finished cooking, what happens is the juices tend to be concentrated in the middle of the meat, and also the muscle fibers will reabsorb that liquid if it lets it sit. If you cut into a roast immediately after roasting, you'll find all the juices just flow right out on the table, on the cutting board. If you let it sit, it's reabsorbed in the meat, not just from the center outward, but the fibers are actually reabsorbing the liquid, so it's very important.
Harold McGee, do you believe this?
Yes, that's exactly what happens.
And I would add one thing, that if we roast at a high temperature, the resting is far more important than it. If the more moderate the heat we use, the resting is still important, but not as crucial. It's you're just not damaging the meat as much. So we think that the resting process in the professional kitchen is still something we very much adhere to. But with a gentler cooking, we find the resting period is shorter.
1-800-423-8255 makes the chemistry in the kitchen connection. Dave is on the line.
Hi.
Hello,
Dave. I got a chicken question.
Okay.
And I don't know whether it's a chemistry problem or a physics problem or some combination of the two, but most of my meals are end up being chicken just from expediency, and frozen chicken an awful lot of the times. And no matter what I do to thaw the chicken, it seems to always come out tougher than unfrozen chicken. I've tried microwaving it. I've tried letting it sit out. I've tried sitting it in warm pans of water and things like that. But what's going on? Is there something chemically happening?
It's a
to the
good
protein?
Practical question. Frozen chicken, thaw it fast, thaw it on the broiler, not freeze it at all, Christopher Kimball?
Well, I have two answers. One is freezing tends to dry out foods. So depending on how long it was frozen, there might be less moisture in the meat. Secondly, to solve the problem, I feel like I published a magazine of brining because we brine everything now, but you could take the chicken, take 2 quarts of water, half a cup of kosher salt, and let it sit in a 1 gallon Ziploc bag for an hour. Take it out, rinse it off, pat it dry, and go ahead and roast it, and it'll be fabulous, even if it's been frozen. It'll put the moisture back in the bird and add a little flavor while you're at it.
Craig Shelton, I know we've got to let you go at the break. I want you to confirm the rumor that a diner's selection of a wine at your restaurant will guide you in some fashion as to how you cook the meal. What's this all about?
Well, you know, years ago, 25 years ago when I was first starting in the kitchens, typically wines on a restaurant menu were bought when they were at, let's say, full maturity, drinking beautifully with 20 or 30 years of age on them. Today we find that the palates are all over the place, and some people enjoy very young wine, some people very old. But we look at it from a palate point of view and physiologically what's happening. I made an example the other day. Last night we had a customer who ordered a very young bottle of Marachet, which is a Chardonnay from France. It was a 1996. And then later on, he ordered another bottle, but much older, a 1982.
We get the drift. Go ahead.
Yeah. Well, the difference is that the older wine is going to have a lower acidity level, and it's going to be much more susceptible to influence from the food.
So I got to ask you to stand by just through the break. 1 minute, Craig Shelton. We'll be back. This is The Connection from WBUR Boston. Funding for The Connection comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where The Connection is produced, and from the Allaire Corporation, empowering people with innovative internet technology and offering dynamic career opportunities at Allaire.com. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is the Chemistry in the Kitchen Connection. We're talking about the science of food with Harold McGee, who wrote The Curious Cook and On Food and Cooking, with Christopher Kimball, who's written, who edits Cook's Illustrated magazine and also wrote a wonderful book, The Yellow Farmhouse Cookbook, and a book of the best recipes, and also Craig Shelton, the chef at the Ryland Inn, four-star Ryland Inn in White House, New Jersey, who was talking about how the age of the wine that the customer chooses guides him in the kitchen. So it's a 3-year-old Chardonnay or a 23-year-old Chardonnay, Craig?
Yeah, we have a blast every night talking about the wines that customers have chosen and then slightly adjusting the dishes to help flatter the wine and make it taste better. If a wine is very young and tends to be acidic or tannic, something like that, we might raise the acidity in the dish gently or add more fat or more enzyme. If the wine is mature and very fragile, we would tend to make the dish more physiologically neutral. It's a great joy for us, and we look at it that every dish shouldn't be cooked the same way, contrary to probably what a lot of restaurateurs think. We're always looking for the context and trying to adjust the dish to that context.
Harold McGee, do you think you could taste the difference? Could you say, I think the chef added a little fat or enzyme in that one?
Well, I think you could certainly tell the difference when you're thinking about the two elements of the meal together. You know, you might not notice that a meal was perhaps a little more delicate than you would expect it to be, or a particular dish. But if you notice that the dish is not overpowering the wine, or that it's not conflicting with the wine, that can make all the difference to the pleasure you take in it.
We can have a real fun experiment for people to do at home with a couple of different Chardonnays. You could take a cold climate Chardonnay, like one maybe from France, and a hot climate one, like one from Australia, and taste them each individually, and they seem to have great balance, and you might enjoy one versus the other as a personal preference. But now bite into a lemon and go back and taste the hot climate Chardonnay, and you'll probably notice the middle palate completely washed out, and it can taste very watery and very woody. A colder climate wine, which has a higher acidity after the lemon, might even improve in your enjoyment of it.
Craig Shelton, I'd love to think I could train myself to notice those differences. It's nice to know that you're thinking about it. thank you enormously for joining us.
It's been a pleasure.
Craig Shelton of the Ryland Inn in White House, New Jersey. 1-800-423-8255. The Chemistry in the Kitchen Connection with Christopher Kimball and Harold McGee. Mary is on the line.
Hi there. I had a question about, I wondered if anyone heard of the book Food in History by Ray Tannehill?
Not I.
Yes.
Yes, okay. Well, that gives a good history of the food in addition to the chemistry. And also I had a question about why do you add just baking powder sometimes, like in muffins, and in a cake you add baking powder and baking soda?
It sounds like Christopher Kimball's question. He's got two pans in front of him, and I don't know what he's going to do with them.
Not blow you up. It's a good question. Baking powder is nothing more than baking soda plus a double-dried starch to stabilize it, plus either one or two types of acid. You use baking powder when you have a batter, for example, that has no other acidic ingredient. Now, buttermilk has a lot of acid in it. Brown sugar has acid in it. Chocolate has acid in it. If you do have acid in the batter, you often just use baking powder. Baking powder, as the experiment I did earlier, reacts with acid to create carbon dioxide gas that creates lift. Another concept is baking powders, some of them are called double acting, and one theory is they were developed for professional bakers where they make a batter and bake it off later. Some of the carbon dioxide is created early on at room temperature, some at baking temperatures. So there's some benefit there. Baking powder creates more of the gas later on when the cake, for example, is ready to absorb it. But basically, baking soda if there's acid in the batter, baking powder if there isn't.
Mary, does that do it?
Just quickly, I've also read that it's very important to have everything at room temperature. Is that true? If you're baking?
It depends. Yes, generally that's true. Butter is the most important thing for creaming. It has to be about 65 to 67 degrees. If that sounds too precise, you just bend the stick and it should be malleable. It shouldn't be melted and it shouldn't be too firm. Otherwise, you can't incorporate enough air into it. Egg whites, for example, I've tested cold versus room temperature, and in terms of a final cake or souffle, it really makes no difference, although that's what the cookbooks say, that it should make a difference. It doesn't.
Cook on, Mary. Thank you. Christopher Kimball, you've got flour and water in two stainless steel bowls here. What are we going to prove now?
Well, you're going to tell me what you see. So we have a half a cup of high-protein flour. There are two kinds of flour. Three kinds. There's high-protein flour, which means it's 12 to 14% protein. That's made from hard wheat. Hard wheat just means the kernels are physically harder than soft wheat. And I put 6 tablespoons of water and I mixed it up, and it looks sort of dense, like a thick dough. I have in the other bowl a half cup of cake flour. Cake flour is made from lower-protein wheat, about 8% to 9% protein. And I have the same amount of water in that, and you're going to see a fairly substantial difference, which is that the cake flour makes up a loose batter. It doesn't absorb the water as well. The high-protein flour will absorb the water much more so. Why does that matter? Well, if you're making a biscuit or muffin and it calls for all-purpose flour, which might be 11% protein, let's say 12%, and you substitute a soft flour like a cake flour, it probably will collapse on you. It won't rise properly because it can't absorb the water properly. The other issue is if you're baking bread and it says use bread flour and you use all-purpose, bread flour is higher protein than all-purpose, and therefore the amount of water you need will change. So a small change in flour can make a big difference. And one last point, flour is not flour. That is, you could have the same flour in May and use the same flour 2 months later. It could be drier or moister. So it isn't always true, like making pie pastry, for example. The amount of water you need, you just never know how much water you need. So the lesson
is
really
don't striking. Trust recipes. I mean, in one bowl, you've got biscuit dough. And the other, you've got what looks
like
cake frosting or something. Yeah.
So the condition.
And that's how much difference in the percentage of protein?
Well, this one is a King Arthur flour. King Arthur flour is unbleached and tends to have very high protein, which is 12 to 13. A bread flour might be as high as 14. Cake flour, softer flour, southern flours like white lily, for example, tend to be lower. They'd be as low as about 8%. So,
and what's made the difference? Is it in the grain of wheat, or is it in the miller's process?
No, it's in the. You can ask Hal for a more technical explanation, but it's the absorption qualities of the wheat that's ground and how well it absorbs water.
But is it different in the wheat kernel as it came out of the you know, out of the field?
Well, there are two things. Yes, that's true. And also whether the flour is bleached or not might have some difference, but it's basically the wheat's different, yes.
That's why French bread tastes different in France than it tastes in New York?
That's a whole other show. That's very confusing.
Hal McGee?
Well, these days, in fact, you can get almost any kind of flour you want by at the mill by playing around with which fractions of the grain go into which bin. So you can actually create a low-protein flour from a high-protein wheat if you want to. But by and large, that's true. You get hard wheat will give you bread flours with a high protein. Soft wheats will give you a low-protein flour.
1-800-423-8255. The chemistry in cooking connection. Joel is on the line.
Hi there.
Hello, Joel.
Great show.
Thank you.
I was hoping you could explain an embarrassing baking incident I had at once. I was baking chocolate chip cookies with my little brother in one of those Big Brother programs, and we put the pan in the oven, and a few minutes later, smoke started billowing out. Mm. We opened the oven up, and the back of the pan of cookies were on fire. We took them out, blew out the flames, and when they cooled off, we ate the molten dough, and it was still very good, actually,
oh,
but
wow.
I never understood what had happened there.
I told you not to put kerosene on that pan.
That could explain it.
What happened?
It sounds to me as though there was some old grease on the back of that pan or something.
Mm.
There's nothing on the back of a pan, an ordinary pan, that's going to ignite in that way. So it must have been some old grease, and it just got too close to the... I imagine this was a gas-fired oven with the flame underneath, so that it would have gotten much hotter there.
Mm-hmm. Well, that makes me feel a lot better, and it was in a co-op, so probably someone hadn't cleaned the pan very well.
But Joel, do you think that, like the famous story of, you know, the first roast pork, did you discover something useful in this process? Was it good for the cookies?
Well, the molten dough was actually very good. Maybe I should try that again, see if I can recreate the flavor.
Thank you, Joel. 1-800-423-8255. David is on the line.
Hi.
Hello, David.
This is a great conversation to hear. I'm a high school physics teacher and in the summertime an avid cook, so this is a really exciting thing to hear about. Mm. I have a question about sugar chemistry, and it's both a practical question and a theory question. About boiling up simple syrup, you know, for making candy in the wintertime or fudge, and then a couple weeks ago I was making an icing for a cake. And, you know, it's bring to soft ball stage, so... You know, heat it up on the stove, got the candy thermometer in there, and two things. One is that I noticed that the temperature of the mixture rises, and then it kind of plateaus, and it kind of sits there for a long time while boiling, and it'll sort of creep up for a long time, and then when it decides it's going to go for softball, it sprints. Like, it dashes for softball, and you got to really be watching at that particular moment and not have gotten bored in the preceding 10 minutes, otherwise you miss it. The practical question is... somehow I always overshoot, and I always end up with a simple syrup that you know gets really hard. In this case, I you know tried to beat it into some egg whites, and you know it caramelized on the side of the bowl. The practical question is: can your guest suggest ways of you know watching out for that, you know, other than just keeping an eye on it, because it always seems to happen as much as I'm careful.
David, Christopher Kimball has an answer.
Okay.
Yeah, I have a simple answer, which is the best piece of equipment to have at home is an instant read thermometer.
Yeah.
And even though they tell you not to do this, I use it to measure the simple syrup. Usually you're looking for 238 degrees, I believe. And candy thermometers, I find, especially with smaller amounts, are sort of hard to read because the difference between 236 and 238 is sometimes not apparent. So I would use an instant read thermometer with a big readout. A good one costs about $40, and you can get it very exact. The other thing is, when you're making Italian meringue, I think, if you were beating the syrup into egg whites, I find that slightly underdoing it is fine. You're better under, you know, a little lower temperature is fine versus a higher temperature. And as far as the temperature, you're right, coming up, it comes up very fast as the water boils away, and then it slows down as you get closer to 238. But I would use an instant read thermometer.
Great. Can I ask the chemistry question?
Sure.
Is there something going on other than just boiling away the water, because that slow creep and plateau is the kind of thing you'd see if there were a phase change of some kind. Is the sugar doing something other than just getting rid of its water?
Harold McGee?
At that point, it's still just basically getting rid of its water, but it may very well be that there is a percentage of water in a sucrose water mixture that is just more tightly bound. And so it's relatively easy to get rid of it up to a certain point, and then it gets more difficult, and then something else may happen. It's a complicated, even though it only involves two chemical species, it is a very complicated system.
David, hope that helps. Keep cooking. 1-800-423-8255. Harry is on the line.
Hi, great show.
Thank you, Harry.
I think my question falls into the category of idle curiosity, but I wonder why, you know, we have markedly different kinds of cuisine in different cultures, Oriental, European, Arabic, Middle Eastern, and so forth. You know, there are, in fact, whole cultures, or practically whole cultures, that are lactose intolerant. I happen to love capers, but I don't know many people who share my preference. What science, if any, is there that accounts for what different people might like or dislike? And you know, you could have two people sitting at the same meal have a very different reaction to it.
Interesting question. Harold McGee, do you have an answer?
Well, I think that's one of those sorts of questions that science can offer hypotheses, but actually to come up with an answer would require massive experiments on a worldwide scale, and that would be tough. But I think there are a couple of things involved. Perhaps the most obvious and maybe the most important one is people have used what has been available to them, and what grows naturally and is available locally varies tremendously across the world. So you end up developing traditions based on the resources that are available to you, and it may simply grow from that.
Christopher Kimball, what's your explanation of sort of the, you know, cultural blocks of taste?
Well, let's give you two examples. I agree with Hal. One is stir fry. You know, why stir fry is an Asian way of cooking. They didn't have a lot of fuel, and they had to cook the food quickly, so they cut it into little tiny pieces, and in 3 minutes it's cooked. So that's why stir fry. Southern cooking was often because people were out working all day, and they needed to have very slow cooking. You put it on the fire, come back 8 hours later, you have a burgoo, or you'd have a stew of some kind. So a lot of it's not just the foods that are available, but it's the lifestyle. If you need to cook low and slow, it's because you're out of the house all day. So it's also the culture in terms of available of fuel, and also if you're going to be around to see the food cooking.
1-800-423-8255. The Chemistry of Cooking Connection. Sue is on the line.
Hi. I wonder if any of the gentlemen on the show have ever heard of a woman named Shirley Caraher.
Yes, we both have heard of her.
Okay. I heard.
Who's she? I haven't heard of her.
Oh, I heard her interviewed on NPR a while back. I don't remember on what program. And she's a chemist. And also, the jacket flap says, a culinary food sleuth. And she was so fascinating that I went out and bought her book called Cookwise. And it's a really great book. And it helped to explain why about 15 years ago when I made what I thought was going to be a lemon meringue pie, it turned out to be a lemon meringue soup. And she describes why she made the mistake and how hurt she thought about it, what led her to do it, and it exactly, you know, step by step, that's exactly how I thought about it and why my pie turned into soup. And it has to do with an egg, something in an egg yolk, something in the egg yolk called alpha amylase, and you have to cook it when it's added to the starch and the sugar and the water. And if you don't recook it and heat it, it's going to eat up all the starch, and you're going to get soup instead of a nice thick.
That's right. No, Shirley's custard. Book Cookwise is wonderful. It's a book of recipes and commentary, explanation of the principles involved, and does a wonderful job.
Well, if I may give Hal McGee a plug, though, On Food and Cooking is the Bible for everybody in this business. So Hal was there first with a great book.
1-800-423-8255. Eva is on the line.
Yes, I am a chemical engineer, a librarian, and even wrote a Hungarian reduced-calorie dessert cookbook. Yet I am puzzled why I don't know the difference between kosher salt and sea salt. I don't know when to use kosher salt and when sea salt. I read all the cooking magazines. I watch all the cooking shows. Some cooks insist on kosher salt, some on sea salt.
Christopher Kimball is here with your answer. Finally, Eva.
Thank you.
There are three kinds of salt. There's kosher salt, which simply has larger grains than table salt, which is finer. So if a recipe calls for a tablespoon, for example, of kosher salt, you would use maybe 2 teaspoons of table salt because per the volume, the weight's different. So kosher salt is less potent per, let's say, tablespoon or teaspoon. But basically, they're the same. Most cooks like to cook with kosher because you can pick it up, leave it in the salt box. The big granules are easy to handle, and they stick to food well. Your question was also about sea salt. I wouldn't use sea salt in baking. The only time I use sea salt or an expensive, high-quality salt is when you can really taste it, like putting it on a bread at the last minute or on top of food. And a good sea salt will have a lot of flavor in it, which you won't find in a processed salt like kosher or table salt.
Harold, do you want to add to any of that?
Just the point of about flavor that Chris has mentioned, and that is that kosher salt, table salt, and sea salt all do taste different, even though they're all salt, because they, in fact, are chemically different. They're mostly sodium chloride. Kosher salt is pure sodium chloride, but table salt has anti-caking agents added to it so that it pours when it rains. And then sea salt has all kinds of other dissolved salts from the ocean water, and that affects flavor as well. Mm. So there are subtle differences to the flavor which you can notice if you're using the salt in a prominent way. Mm. If you're mixing it into a dish with 20 other ingredients, of course, it'll become less obvious.
There you go, Eva. Your lifelong quest has been answered on The Connection. 1-800-423-8255, The Chemistry of Cooking Connection. Matthew is on the line.
Hi.
Welcome, Matthew.
Simple question. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Okay, good. Why does lasagna always taste better left over?
Why does the Thanksgiving turkey taste better on Sunday?
Everything, right. Everything's always better the next day or 2 days later.
Very, very good question.
I'll give you the cook's answer. I'll give you the scientific answer. It's true. Even apple pie, I think, tastes better the next day. I think flavors have a chance to meld and sit and soften and get more complex. I find a stew or a lasagna, when you first eat it, the individual flavors haven't really come together. And then the next day, it's a much more sophisticated group of flavors. And Hal can tell you specifically why that happens. Right?
Well,
do you buy the premise, Harold?
I'll try my best. In the case of something like a lasagna or something that you reheat, you're getting a chance to recook the food and to get some more browning reactions going that generate flavor so that you'll actually have more flavor molecules in a food that's been refrigerated and then reheated than you would have had in the original food. And I think Chris is also absolutely right about the blending of flavors. When something has the chance to sit, the flavors get to integrate better so that the next time you have it, it's a more subtle kind of flavor.
What are the exceptions? I mean, day-old coffee, it doesn't taste better.
That's right.
What doesn't taste better, Christopher?
Day-old margaritas. they're terrible.
Yeah. This is a whole lot of fun. Harold McGee, thank you.
The author
of On Food and Cooking, the father of chemically wise cooking, and Christopher Kimball, the editor of Cook's Illustrated magazine and The Best Recipe and the Yellow Farmhouse Cookbook. Thanks to the callers and listeners, and thanks also to Craig Shelton, who joined us earlier. Listeners, you can continue to learn and teach about cooking on our website at theconnection.org. We had help today from Asher Hawkins, Michael Garth, Rebecca Smuckler, and Kim Bichari. The Connection is produced by Catherine Bidwell, Dan First, Hitesh Hatti, Jill Kaufman, Amy McDonald, Jake Shields, and Keith Shields, Jake Shapiro and Keith Shields. Mary McGrath is our senior producer. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection from WBUR Boston. Funding for The Connection comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where The Connection is produced, and from the Allaire Corporation. PRI, Public Radio International.
This is WBUR. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Cayman Systems, a newly reorganized company providing digital freedom to change the way people work, live, and play. Now hiring for all positions on the web at